Well, good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, whenever you're listening. This is Davisville on KDRTLP 95.7 FM in Davis, California. You can find us online anytime at kdrt.org/Davisville. I'm Bill Buchanan, I'm your host, and today we enjoy Davisville's annual fall movie show, in which Davis film critic Derek Bang tells us about movies he's looking forward to as the year ends, and perhaps some he'll dodge if he sees them sauntering his way. Maybe if they come even more aggressively than sauntering.
Well, I can, sometimes I can't dodge rapidly enough.
Yeah, Derek, my friend, it's so good to share this venue with you every year.
Thank you, Bill. It's always fun to be here. You know, doing this now for a decade and a half.
Well, I think the first movie we actually talked about when it was released was one of Chaplin's silent movies.
I see.
Yeah, that's how far back we go, Derek.
I see. That makes me a little older than I thought I was.
Well, aren't we all? Or younger some days. Anyway, I love this tone of this show. So at the end of the year is typically when the big and or substantial movies come out. You notice what I did there. The big aren't necessarily substantial.
True.
But anyway, we'll talk about the delights and the disasters that you see coming our way. This year, though, there are a couple of movie trends that I want to talk about first. I want to get your take on, because you've been writing criticism forever, and you got to have thoughts about this. One, surprisingly, is the idea that movies are getting longer. And to me, that seems to defy the common wisdom that collectively, you know, our attention spans are just atomized and small and scattered. I need to set this up a little. This idea came to me from a New Yorker magazine article last January that Daniel Immerwahr wrote, titled, "What If the Attention Crisis is All a Distraction? The problem isn't our ability to focus, it's what we're focusing on." All right, so this is about a lot of things other than just movies, but as part of his argument, he makes the point that the average length of a top 10 grossing film grew by more than 20 minutes between 1993 and 2023. His point is people will still pay attention to a long story as long as it engages them. He sees echoes also in the glut of sequels. So in other words, not only is the individual movie getting longer, but it becomes part of a sometimes seems endless stream of sequels.
Oh, we're looking at you, Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Well, I didn't want to name names, but, you know, it's in the eye of the beholder, of course. But also on TV, or streaming, as we'd say these days, you know, where sitcoms and dramas used to wrap up neatly in half an hour, or maybe an hour if it was a prestigious show. You know, they had these self-contained episodes. Now they have story arcs. They're longer. He also refers to video games, which I thought was a really interesting point, because his point was they're very long stories, if you think about it that way. All right, so you've been reviewing movies for 50 years. You know, are they longer than they were, and what do you make of this?
What do I make of it?
Yeah.
The short answer is I'm thoroughly fed up with it.
Oh, tell me more.
Okay, what's missing from the introduction that you just gave is the discussion of quality of the result. Extended length, in my view, often is synonymous with unrestrained self-indulgence, which is not a good thing. So I went back and I examined what seems to have been the beginnings of this phenomenon in recent times. And the current manifestation appears to have begun in 2021 with Drive My Car, which was 3 hours long. And I'm talking now exclusively about Best Picture nominees. It was, in my opinion, a yawn. I know people liked it, but I don't think it made enough money to justify its length, and I don't think the story justified its length. Dune, that same year, and Nightmare Alley were both 2.5 hours long each. I would say they better justified their length. In 2022, Killers of the Flower Moon was 3.5 hours long, and Oppenheimer was 3 hours. Both are regarded as masterpieces. Do they justify their length? I'm a little fuzzy about that particular answer. In 2023, The Brutalist was a butt-numbing 3.5 hours long. I thought I was going to die. And both Dune Part 2 and Wicked ran more than 2.5 hours. Now, in the case of Wicked, that's longer than the original stage play, and that movie was only the first half of the story. You know, we're getting the second half this coming week.
Well, and now you make this point, I think, in your latest review of The Running Man, that you thought that was too long.
It was. It was at least one violent sequence too long, okay, to be specific about it. There's a lot happening here. Hollywood seems to have decided that popular franchises arbitrarily warrant extended length. Avengers Endgame ran 3 hours. The final two Mission Impossible films were just shy of 3 hours. Funny thing there, I thought Part 7 was a great film, held my attention the entire time. I thought the most recent one, Part 8, was a total dog. It was nothing but a vanity show for Tom Cruise. Boring, dull. If they sell tickets regardless, I guess you can justify it on the basis of the studio and the commercial standpoint. But here's the important detail. One of the important details. Movie theater owners hate long movies because that means fewer trips to the snack bar in a given day. And that's where they make their money. I worked at the Varsity Theater back in the day, and I saw, you know, the income expense sheets. And at that point in time, typically, when you opened a movie like, let's say, Star Wars, the first X number of weeks, the studio would get 90% of the ticket take, and the theater would get 10%. And then after, say, 5 weeks, it would go 80-20, and then maybe 70-30, and then maybe 60-40. Well, how many movies hang around for more than 3 or 4 weeks these days?
Yeah, it's totally changed with streaming and all that, right? By the time it gets that kind of longevity, it's probably in your home screen.
Right. It's, you know, and we wonder why movie theaters are struggling. So they hate it. And the other aspect of this conversation is super long movies aren't new. Gone with the Wind ran 4 hours. Lawrence of Arabia, just shy of 4 hours. It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, 3.5 hours. They're all regarded as classics of their form. Cleopatra ran 4 hours in movie theaters, and a recently restored version, which you can watch at home, runs more than 5 hours, God help us. But such long films were a rare exception, and they were promoted as special events.
Yeah, they had intermissions, and you know, the curtain
and would that's fall. The thing. They had intermissions.
Yeah.
You could get up for 5-10 minutes. Walk around, stretch your legs, visit the restroom, buy something else at the snack bar.
So you're making, I think, a pretty interesting point here, which is to say length is fine if it's merited, if the story merits.
Sure.
And yet they've been getting longer lately. You've noted that yourself. Daniel Immerwahr is pointing it out. But he doesn't really talk about quality, at least at that part of the article. But you are, and you're saying the quality is worse and the length is longer. That sounds like both things are going in the wrong direction.
I would argue that that's absolutely true. And they're no longer special events because it happens too frequently. You don't know that you're going to be trapped by a 3-hour movie, you know, unless you study up on it beforehand, until you're actually in the seat and you're about 2 hours in and you're thinking, oh, my God, is this thing ever going to end?
Well, OK, but see, you don't know because you're the critic. The rest of us who read your criticism or... or other critics will know. We'll say, okay, I see that 4-hour thing coming my way.
No, but my point here is that if such overlong epics become routine, which seems to be the case, anything routine always includes a higher percentage of junk.
Oh, okay.
Having said that, I'll back away from it a little by reminding that we must recall Roger Ebert's law. No good movie is too long, and no bad movie is short enough.
Yeah, that kind of does sum it up, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
And some of these then should not have gotten out, though, I guess is the point, that something has changed in the economics of movies or, you know, taste is always fickle.
I think it's lazy. Directors and studios know they can get away with it.
Oh, in other words, make 10 longer movies rather than 12 or 15 somewhat shorter ones?
And, I think so.
Yeah. You know.
And that's also not good.
You know, he says something else in the article, which I think is interesting. It takes us a little bit away from movies, but maybe not. I'd like to get your take on this, too. Immerwahr says part of the problem is that cultural creators, especially those in legacy media, which I think would include film studios and, you know, radio show hosts, among others, fear that smartphones will lure their audiences away. In this, they don't seem vastly different from 18th century priests decrying novels for turning women away from prayerful obedience. He says, is the ostensible crisis of attention at bottom a crisis of authority? Is it people aren't paying attention? Is that just a dressed-up version of people aren't paying attention to me? In other words, the incumbent creative class, you know, who make movies, stories, books, plays, etc., they're jealous of the attention that audiences heap on TikTok. Do you buy the idea that, I guess maybe you've already answered this, but that there's still room for long storylines, if maybe not in the familiar format that movies have made them?
Formats always change. Once upon a time, we only had live theater, right?
Yeah.
Then Much later, we had movies. Books came before that. Extended magazine articles. To me, that argument sounds like overthinking. There will always be content made for whatever people are willing to absorb in that particular fashion. And people have always enjoyed long storylines if they're done well. It's why series characters are so popular. I tend to think of all the Sherlock Holmes stories as one really long novel. But you get them in easily digestible bursts.
And I suppose, too, like the Sherlock Holmes series, it creates a world that you enter as a viewer, and that's part of the fun.
That's absolutely correct. And I'd argue that the best long-form stories, regardless of format, are presented in easily digestible chunks. I think that's why people are much more willing to read a pair of 200-page novels as opposed to a single 400-page novel. You know you're going to have a break in between, even if you're dealing with two novels that, you know, one follows the other.
It gets back to the intermission idea.
It's the intermission idea.
All right, well, there's a couple other things I want to get to before we get to your takes on movies to see and shun. I want to be alliterative here. It's another interesting movie observation that film comedies have changed to accommodate the shift from big to small screen. And in the process, we, the audience, lose the cues from fellow audience members whose laughs alert us to things we might miss. And this has reminded me of a point that you've made several times, that movies are better watched in an audience, in a crowd, rather than by yourself. The idea with a comedy in particular is, and I've had this experience, I go to see a movie and it's a comedy and a laugh gets past me. I don't get it. But I hear other people laughing and I suddenly go, oh, what did I miss? You know, it's kind of like a cue where I'll listen and I'll think, wait, what? You know, and then maybe I'll enjoy something that I do like. I just missed that moment. Does he have a point about comedies and the value of watching movies with other people, which is to say that the audience kind of cues us in, helps us focus?
Well, I dispute the premise. I don't think comedies are in any shorter supply than any other genre you could point to in terms of movies.
Well, I think you're saying not shorter supply, just that they've changed, that they've become more, and I think you'd see this with Saturday Night Live. You know, they know people tend not to watch that as a show anymore. They watch skits on their phone the next day.
Some people do. Some people still watch the show. Some people still go to movies. Studios, so far, are still generating quite a lot of films for the big screen. I mean, I know they are. I see and or avoid, you know, as many of them as possible. But it is certainly true that the entire filmmaking market is putting more effort into targeting home viewership, which I lament. Movie theaters were struggling even before the pandemic, which made the situation critical. And today I fear that the quote-unquote movie theater experience is on life support. It doesn't help that entities like Amazon, Netflix, Disney, and Apple TV Plus are encouraging top-flight actors, directors, and writers to produce content directly for the home-viewing audience. And it is a shame, not only because I hate to see movies disappear, but also because, yes, it is more fun to watch a film with a packed audience, assuming it's a well-behaved packed audience, of course. It's not merely because we pick up on each other's cues and reactions, but also because shared experiences are good for the soul and one's mental health. And it's good for social health and maintaining the all-important sense of community, which is something that is also fragmenting rather badly these days. Mm-hmm. I think it's all the fault of not going to movies with groups of people, quite frankly.
Okay, people, you have your moral charge. Go find some friends and go to a theater and see a good movie. You know, don't see one of the long, bloated ones. So I have one more item here, and this actually kind of ties into that movie experience. And this was something NBC reported in February. A court in India ordered compensation for a man who was obliged to watch too many movie theater ads. And so this is, you know, sort of an official recognition that those ads are over the top. Now, surely you've noticed the weed-like proliferation of ads and trailers before movies over the length of your career. Do you side with the judge in this case?
Oh, absolutely. I love this story. You mentioned to me that the plaintiff was awarded financial damages.
Yeah.
And in regulatory fines, which I think is terrific.
Yeah, he paid $10 for the ticket, and he was awarded $320 in damages and $1,150 in regulatory fines.
That's a good return.
Yeah.
It's false advertising, isn't it? Really?
Oh, you mean to say a movie starts at a certain time?
And you know, to say a claim the movie starts at 2 o'clock, if it really starts at 2:30. Earlier this year, a Connecticut state senator proposed legislation that would require movie theaters to list both start times, the time that the trailers start and the ads, and then also the time for the actual film. Now, the bill is still pending. I'm not hopeful, but it's interesting that it was brought up at all. My wife and I now make a point of arriving at least 15 minutes late to a Regal screening. I suspect 25 minutes would be safe, and the delay sometimes stretches to a whole half hour. But I get paranoid that if we push it too far, that'll be the one time the pre-show is shorter. And the worst part is when you see the same commercial more than once. Mm-hmm. And that's happening a lot more lately. So here's my question. Let's make up an example. The Ford Motor Company pays Regal Entertainment Group headquarters in Knoxville, Tennessee, a fee to be allowed to run a 30-second commercial in front of every screening in every theater. How much of that fee trickles down to our movie theater here in Davis? And does that amount sufficiently compensate for the number of people who've stopped going to theaters because they're fed up with all the ads? I don't think so.
Yeah, fair question, Derek. I kind of feel for the theaters here, right? I mean, the audience is drifting away. The movies are encouraging movies made for the small screen. And then, you know, they're hoping to make their money from popcorn or selling loud, obnoxious ads for the first 20, 30 minutes. I say that from experience. My wife and I went to go see Nuremberg yesterday at Regal in town. And it was, as you said, I think it was about a half hour of ads. And there might have been some trailers in there after the announced start time before the movie began.
Right.
I had my phone. I just pretended as much as I could that I wasn't actually sitting in there having this stuff pummeling. That's what it felt like.
And of course, like a good boy, you turned your phone off when the movie began, right?
I did. But when I usually when I sit down to theater, the first thing I do is turn my phone off. And I thought, nah, I don't need to this time.
Right.
We're doing our annual movie interview program with Derek Bang, Davis film critic. This is Davisville on KDRT 95.7 FM. KDRT.org/Davisville. I'm Bill Buchanan. All right, Derek, let's get to the star attraction of this annual review. Well, maybe not the star. I don't know. I kind of like that first part, but I always look forward to this. What movies are you looking forward to as 2025 winds down, and which do you plan to avoid?
It looks like a pretty good list for the most part this year. Director Chloe Zhao's Nomadland was a Best Picture winner a few years back, so I'm intrigued by her new film, Hamnet, which is kind of sort of a modern retelling of the Shakespeare play.
Of Hamlet, yeah.
Of Hamlet. I loved the first two Knives Out movies. We're getting a third one, Wake Up, Dead Man, a Knives Out mystery. Jay Kelly, writer-director Noah Baumbach's study of film star played by George Clooney, who confronts his past and his legacy, is bound to be terrific. James L. Brooks' movies are always worth watching. He did Broadcast News in Terms of Endearment, As Good as It Gets, and he hasn't directed one since 2010, so I'm really eager to see Ella McKay. Bradley Cooper's Is This Thing On looks promising. Interesting.
Now is that a microphone you're talking about?
I'll not say.
Okay.
And then Timothy Chalamet has very intriguing taste in projects, so I'm curious about his new film, Marty Supreme. Also looks very interesting. What do I plan to avoid?
Well, but before you get to those, this sounds like a better list than you've had in more recent years.
It is, definitely.
So is the industry coming back a little bit, do you think?
I mean, I would like to think so.
Okay. So maybe
one December does not a trend make.
Okay. So it could be coincidence or it could be hopeful, but in any event, there's a good list there. Okay, so on to the dogs. No offense, dogs.
Avatar, Fire and Ash. I fell asleep during the second one, which was 3 hours and 15 minutes long. And this one's going to be 3 hours and 15 minutes long. And the second one was just a redo of the first one with a lot of stuff from Titanic thrown in. I think James Cameron has lost his sense of newness.
Now, I got to admit, I didn't see the Avatar movies, but I'm intrigued with the idea of merging Avatar with Titanic. I now have this image in my head of Leonardo DiCaprio and
there's a very lengthy sequence toward the end of the second Avatar film that involves the sinking of a large vessel, which plays out pretty much note for note and beat for beat the way the final sequences in Titanic played out.
I've just learned some obscure bit of film trivia there, a future bar question. Okay.
There's a comedy coming out called Anaconda about a bunch of muddleheads who get together to try to remake their favorite horror movie and I guess wind up confronting an actual giant anaconda. I don't know. I don't care. I'm not going to watch it.
I'm intrigued with your word muddlehead. I haven't heard that word before, but I can kind of instantly picture what you mean.
And I'm ashamed to admit, I think it was a couple of years ago at this point, that I sat through a horrible horror movie called Five Nights at Freddy's, which was kind of a riff on the Chuck E. Cheese phenomenon where the animatronic animals inside came to life and started killing people. Would you believe we're getting a sequel to that silly thing?
Well, this kind of goes back to our theme at the start of the show, right? It's like it.
I mean, we need the opposite of that famous Star Trek line. Let's not make it so.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's true. Picard doesn't have that power, does he? He can say make it so. That was his famous line in Star Trek right. Next Generation. But not make it so is undo this.
Please.
Okay. Well, but apparently not in time for this.
And then there are a couple I'm not sure about. Song Sung Blue.
Neil Diamond's got a theme, right?
Stars Hugh Jackman and Kate Hudson as a husband and wife Neil Diamond tribute act who experience, and now I'm quoting, soaring success and devastating heartbreak in their musical journey together, unquote.
That's a quote that sounds like just rolled right off your tongue there. I mean, I'm sure a PR person didn't write that.
I mean, it's Hugh Jackman. It could be a lot of fun. It could be a horrible misfire. Facum Hill. A spoof of Downton Abbey. Now, again, there's a lot to make fun of there. But that's the sort of tightrope walk that you have to do very, very carefully or the whole thing collapses.
I guess if you make fun of it in sort of a smart way, right, then that can be kind of – but if you – okay. I think you're right. I think when something is so vivid like that, to make fun of it, you really can go wrong, I guess is what I'm saying. I'm not really...
Well, I'm looking at it this way. Mel Brooks and Gene Wilder waited decades before they made Young Frankenstein. Mm-hmm. And they got it right.
And Downton Abbey, who was more recently with us. Okay. So is that your list?
Those are the high points.
And now, of all those, do you think you'll get to review them all?
The good ones, I hope, yes. The three that I'd rather avoid, I hope I'm successful in avoiding.
Well, now, I guess I've asked you this question before, too, that because, I mean, you write your review for The Enterprise, and you write two a week, usually, for your blog, Derek Bang on Film. Do you feel obligated to see movies that get a lot of attention, but that you don't have much hope for?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, rule number one is I always try to review stuff that people can see. So I pay attention to what's playing at the Regal Davis complex and also at the Varsity Theater. And I always try to give anything there priority.
So if a bad movie is coming your way, but it's playing in town, you're probably going to go see it.
That means I may have to sit through Avatar.
But don't you want to see how this ship sinking thing turns out?
Well, no, this one's going to be, it's called Fire and Ash. So see, they did water in the second one. Now we're moving on to fire. So
yeah, the ship might be back.
I'm expecting a redo of the Towering Inferno.
Okay. There's one for people to look up. That was a big movie in the 70s. It was a disaster movie. I'm acquainting our audience with that if they don't know. That was Charlton Heston, wasn't it, in that one? Did I get that wrong?
No, Charlton Heston was in Earthquake.
Steve McQueen.
Oh.
Steve McQueen and Paul Newman, who were battling it out for top credit.
That's why our engineer here, Jim. And see, this is the thing about movies like that is like if you know the answer, you kind of just have to say it because you don't want people to get the wrong idea that it was Charlton Heston, not Steve McQueen. It's the end of the year. Part of the premise for doing this show in every November for the last 12, 13 years is that's when the big movies come out, the substantial ones. Is that still true?
Yes, and you know why?
Yeah, why?
Because movie studios have decided that Academy voters have very short memories.
Oh, so in other words, if you don't come out with your Oscar bait or what you hope is...
In November or December, and God forbid you should release it in February or March, it's worse than yesterday's news. It feels like it's 5 years ago news.
So that's a comment on just the transience of our Oh, pop culture, at least, anyway.
Well, I mean, Academy voters aren't necessarily representative of the general population. So I don't, you know, I've found that to be a bit of a conundrum, because I would expect them to be more respectful of the medium and be willing to put the time into keeping in mind something that they saw and loved back in spring, as opposed to front loading. The problem with front loading in November and December is that inevitably some get lost in the shuffle.
Well, that's it. As a viewer, it gets hard to keep up, particularly around then. I mean, less so since you can watch things later and streaming and all that. But back in the days when really the only time you could see the movie is when it came out, unless there was a revival sometime. Yeah, well, you might have 8 movies you wanted to see between December 15th and January 5th. And
right. There
happens to be a few other things going on that time of year.
But yeah, I could think of a couple.
Yeah, so it kind of made it hard. But, you know, this reminds me, too, and it's something I think I've read that Steve Martin said. It struck me as a little poignant, actually, because he's had quite a career. But he was talking about making these movies and then how, whatever they are, it's just another title on the shelf when all is said and done, you know. Which is a way to say that even the really great ones, after a while, just become, you know, a title in a library or, you know, in a queue, I suppose.
That sort of reminds me of a wonderful remark that Stephen King made. This was years ago when a reporter commenting on the latest adaptation of one of his books, which was not a very good adaptation, said something along the lines of, "Doesn't it annoy you when a movie ruins one of your books like this?" And King looked at him and turned around and pointed at the book on a shelf behind him and said, "Didn't ruin the book. It's right there."
That's the wisdom of someone who's had to learn perspective over a long career. Or very near the end, you have perspective from a long career. In fact, last year it was 50 years, so this year's...
I know, 51.
51. So, I mean, give me your take on movie going overall. I mean, do you feel like it's sort of bumbling along? Do you feel like it's getting better, getting worse?
Well, as I said earlier, I fear for the movie theater going experience. It is rare, even when we see sneak previews now, to have a full house. I mean, there was a time when people would line up around the block for an early screening, just about any early screening, even bad ones. And inevitably, there would be turnaways because they're like, you know, the people who put these early screenings together, they're like airlines. They overbook because they want a full house. And these days, that's less common. And boy, I mean, if you can't get people to come out for a free movie, then I would say things are looking pretty dire.
And free being the screenings that you're seeing.
Right. And yes, as we've discussed, a lot of stuff, you don't have to see it in a theater because with few exceptions, it'll be available at home in between 4 to 6 weeks. And that's another problem because the window, the mandated window by contract between studios and whether it's a TV station or a streaming channel used to be half a year.
Yeah.
And then more recently, it shortened to 90 days. And then during the pandemic, it basically vanished.
I've read that the 4 chief things afflicting theaters, 1 is the price of tickets, 2 is the ads, 3 is that shorter period between, and 4th is online media. People can stream, things like that.
Right.
But you've also given us all of our marching orders, Derek. We have to go out and see movies with other people.
Yes, you do.
It's good for our cultural set. Derek, thank you, as always, and happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you, Bill. Same to you.
We've been talking with Derek Bang, Davis Film Critic, our annual film movie show. I'm Bill Buchanan. This is Davisville, KDRT 95.7 FM, KDRT.org online. Thank you for listening.